Today is January 16, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing George Foreman over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. George, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born January 10th, 1949 in Marshall, Texas.
And where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in Houston, Texas.
And when did you first start participating in sports?
Well, I can remember participating in sports as far as I can remember back, but it was actually in middle school, well, junior high school, that I had my first experience with football.
And did you have any relatives, older brothers, or did your father encourage you in football?
Matter of fact, I didn't have anyone else participating in sports family-wise. As I can remember, I was about the first one in my immediate family to even participate in organized sports.
And so,
as a team.
And who motivated you or encouraged you to do that?
I'd always liked sports since I was little, and just the neighborhood boys would practice in the afternoon basketball, and we'd see, watch television, and the first hero I truly had was the great running back from the Cleveland Browns, was Jim Brown.
Mm.
My motivation.
Yeah, so you looked up to Jim Brown.
I really looked at Jim Brown. He was the first person I'd seen. I guess once I saw him without his helmet, that was something you seldom see on television back in the day. But I decided that's who I wanted to be.
Huh. So when did you first become involved in boxing?
My boxing was really, I was 17 year old already before I really gotten into boxing. I went into the Job Corps Center in 1965, and after spending a year there, I decided that, over a little story, I told everyone that I was a bully. Everybody called me a bully, and they said, if I was so tough, why didn't I become a boxer? So when I went to Pleasanton, California, to the Job Corps Center, that's where I first got my first introduction to boxing. I was already 17.
Mm. And was there anybody in boxing that you looked up to or that you thought about emulating?
The first boxing match that I really paid some attention to was back in the day of Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston. He hadn't changed his name to Muhammad Ali yet. That was the first boxing match, and I noticed that all of my older brother, and his friends came to listen to it on the radio, and they were real interesting. And I was really interested how all of them could be interested in one event, and it was a boxing match. And that was my first experience of truly watching or listening to a boxing match with the radio then.
Mm-hmm. And how did that affect your motivation in boxing?
I saw it. And I truly wasn't motivated. I wasn't motivated at that time to be a boxer, but that was my first, that was my introductory into what boxing was all about, listening to the radio, one guy pulling one way, another pulling another way.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Job Corps experience and my telling the kids that I would be a boxer, that really was my probably... my first step into the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, describe the path to the Olympic trials. What were some of your major victories and accomplishments on the way to the Olympic trials?
Well, in boxing, you have to win a major tournament to even qualify for the Olympic trials. And I'd won initially the San Francisco Golden Glove. I had one fight, but my advisor and manager at that time in the amateur division, Doc Brodus, really said I needed more experience. So he had me to go to Las Vegas, where I fought another tournament, major tournament, hoping I'd get more fights, and I actually lost. But that one fight I'd won in San Francisco qualified me for the Olympic trials in Ohio. And eventually, that same year, because I was part of the Golden Glove in San Francisco, they sent me on a tour of Germany to box. We had two boxing matches there, a whole team from the United States. And I won one boxing match there and disqualified the other, picking up experience as I went. So those fights, one after another, that qualified me, and then the trip to Europe really gave me some international experience. And after qualifying for the Olympic trials, of course, in Ohio again, I won the heavyweight Olympic trials there.
Mm.
And that qualified me, of course, again for, I won the national AAU tournament there because of the Golden Glove that qualified me for the national team, because you have to be on a national team to qualify for the Olympic trials.
Mm-hmm.
Won the San Francisco Golden Glove, qualified me for the national AAU, and I had about four boxing matches there. That qualified me for the trials. This is all, as a matter of fact, in 68. And, of course, I was successful in the Olympic trials, winning four boxing matches there. And then it was just hanging on for the United States Olympic team because that qualified me.
Mm-hmm. So how did your friends and family and the people that knew you back home, how did they react to finding out that you had made the Olympic team?
Well, it's strange. The strangest thing is I had my first truly organized boxing match in February of 67. Now, October of 68, I'm on the Olympic team. With at that time, about less than 19 boxing matches, I think, total. So no one really had a lot of expectation for me, because first to hear I'm boxing, next thing you know I'm on the Olympic team and with a handful of boxing matches. And so everyone was surprised, but because I'd made the Olympic team, it meant traveling. I didn't even get a chance to talk to a lot of people, become friends, explain it to a lot of people. There was not a lot of press in those days. No one really knew. My mom didn't really believe I was a boxer until actually she saw me on the Olympic trials on television.
Oh, wow. So they were pretty shocked, I imagine.
Yeah, a lot of people just shocked because they heard about I was supposed to be a tough kid, but they didn't really understand, really believe I was going to get that deep into boxing.
Right. So they must
have been. So it was sort of surprised, even to myself.
Yeah. Well, they must have been very proud.
Everybody expressed, once I made the Olympic team, I called the local newspaper there, and I told them that I'd like to tell all my friends that George Foreman, and I knew no one knew me in Houston as George Foreman. They called me Monkey, a monk. And I said to please tell all my friends I'd made the Olympic team. This actually from the Olympic trials, Olympic training camp. And I said, but don't say George Foreman. You got to put George Monkey Foreman. Otherwise, they won't know who I am.
Oh, how funny.
And so the reporter did as much, put in the local four-time newspaper that I had become a part of the Olympic team. Then people in Houston were alerted.
Yeah, and what was the general reaction then?
Yeah, but remember, I'm in, by this time I'm part of the Olympic team, so I didn't have a lot. I didn't. There wasn't no one to text. There wasn't a text in those days. There wasn't a lot of telephones. You had to find a phone even to call.
Yeah.
So my parents told me later on there was a big reaction, but I didn't get that experience. I was too far away. But
Right.
I was happy to let them know that I was doing it. And speaking with my mom, she was proud because she had read in the newspaper as much.
Yeah, so tell me about some of the preparations after you made the team. What preparations do you remember? And was there, for example, preparing for the high altitude of Mexico City or anything like that?
Yeah, once we made the Olympic team, we all then became, it was no more maybe him, maybe not him. We all became one team. There was a team coach selected, Pappy Gault, of course, and which means we'd have to travel to high altitude, and this would take me to New Mexico. And I forgot the city at this point, but we trained at a college. They had rooms for us at a college with dormitory way up in the hills of New Mexico. And so it consisted of high altitude training, running and exercising. And we had a gym there where we box and train and work out daily. And that was great. I was so big, I didn't have a lot of sparring there because I was the only heavyweight on the team.
Yeah. And what did you weigh at the time, and what was your height?
I was about 6'2", 212 pounds.
Oh, wow. Well, do you remember experiencing any of the effects of high altitude when you first got to the training camp?
I remember I hit to hear everyone talk about the altitude and that we were high. And so when you hear everyone talking about it, you assume that you are feeling it because everyone is talking about it. And I had that assumption, but that's all I can tell you then. I assumed I had some effects. It did affect me.
Right.
I assumed. And
Yeah.
even now I assume, but to have an absolute conclusion about it, I don't know.
Okay. Well, was there anyone on the Olympic team with whom you were particularly close? Like, did you have a good friend, or did you make a good friend?
Now there were about I think 11 or 12 of us. I'm not certain the number. And now I had to sit down and count from lightweight, many lightweights, and you go all the way up to heavyweights. Could be nine. I just can't remember. It'll take a moment. But I was friends with everyone on the team because I was one of the young ones. I was 19, and I did a lot of horse planning. The others were pretty mature about it, and they laughed at me because I continued to play all the time, play too much, they called me. But Ronnie Harris was actually the lightweight on the team, and we became good friends. His dad was part of the team. His dad, wherever he'd box, his dad on his by his own expense would travel to be close to him, and so I became close with Ron Harris in particular.
Okay. Well, do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or possible boycotts by members of the US team in the months leading up to the Olympic Games?
Even before we'd gotten to Mexico City, there was a lot of talk because the then famous Kareem Jabbar, who was representing would qualify for the basketball team, was from Los Angeles, and a few other of the athletes made statements that they may not participate because of someone had organized a boycott, and they were all talking about it. But remember, at this point, I'm not even possible of making the Olympic team. I've had like, let me if I can, let me see, I won the Golden Gloves. Take me a moment to try to calculate this. Won the Golden Gloves, four fights there, the Olympic trials, that's eight fights, I think another box off. I had about 10 fights, and I had a total of 24 boxing matches.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 of those were just qualifying for the Olympic trials. So at this point, there is no celebrity attached to my name. No one would even talk to me because who is that? But the track guy, track and field guys, basketball guys, and some other teams were approached by people who about boycotting the team. They were celebrity, but people like myself, we weren't even spoken to, let alone approached. So we heard on television about it, but that's about as far as it had gotten.
Mm-hmm.
Once I won the Olympic trials and made the team, we traveled to Denver, Colorado, which I really felt the high altitude there.
Okay.
You'd lose your breath, but we was only there for a week or so. And when I was sitting in the room, there were a couple of people came by to visit me by way of someone else who knew the team. They asked me, would I please be a part of Richard Nixon's campaign. They felt he was going to become the president of the United States, and they asked me to help. I remember that. And I remember some of the other guys talking about being approached, not the boxers, by people from the who are going to boycott the Olympic. Then they call off the boycott, and they said the guys were going to do other things other than boycott the Olympics. But let me see, there were at least four members of my boxing team who were actually Korea military people. Art Redding was serving in the armed forces. Oh, and they'll just, these people were called patriotic to the fullest degree, and I'd hear them talk about what someone was going to do in the Olympics, and they really thought it was an ugly situation. So I listened to them pretty clearly and took on whatever attitude they had.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no one better talk to me about that foolishness. No one ever spoke to me about it, but I still had that attitude like, no one better speak to me about that foolishness.
Yeah.
Because of the influence of the armed forces, guys on the armed forces on the team. They were pretty leader type guys.
Right, right.
And that was my adventure and the only adventure I had into a probable boycott.
Sure, sure. Well, do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
We heard a lot about it. We were being warned to steer clear, and maybe we shouldn't go out of the Olympic Village because there was so much carrying on, and there was probably, and they squashed a lot of it before we got in there, all of the protests, and it was a lot of really rough on a lot of students about it, especially in Mexico, and they asked us to kind of stay close to the village and not to wander off too far because we may find ourselves into some trouble too. And that frightened us too. And because of that, they told us maybe we should, you know, generally there's a lot of visiting of landmarks and all of that. They asked us to stay into the village and not to do as much because of the danger.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were your impressions of Mexico City and the people there when you first arrived?
Well, it gave us a nice talking to some fellow Olympians from the past, told us about the proud people of Mexico and don't take them lightly. And they'd given us some stories about how they really had a lot of pride and they loved their country. And don't think that America, go there and think Americans are better than people from Mexico, and they give us a lot of, so I was on the alert. But once I got there, everyone I met from Mexico was kind, really kind. They were generous. And just like we were proud to be on the Olympic team, it seemed they were proud to be hosting the Olympics in their country as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you think of the Olympic Village?
Now, the Olympic Village was something special. All of us boxers had our own floor, as a matter of fact. And daily we'd get up and exercise and go out to the – that's we all of us end up doing road work around the track. And we see all the celebrity track stars out there running and stretching and all of those things. Go back and clean up and then head to the chow hall where they had the most delicious and all kind of the food was a variety of delicious foods. And you could eat as much as you want. Walk around after and then go back and lay down. And we were careful about drinking the water. A couple of us had some incidents where we didn't know about the water and we accidentally would drunk some and got sick. But other than that, we loved the village. It was a place where you could walk around. And I was told, I'd see guys who looked just like me walk up to them and, hey, how you doing, man? And they speak another language. That was all brand new to me. The people from all over the country, the only thing that differentiated us from one another were the colors we wore. Track suits, red, white, and blue, or whatever other colors from other countries. That's when I started to realize pride in your country, the colors you wear, are who we were.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are your memories from the opening ceremony?
And there were a couple of guys on our team who had been to previous Olympics, and they warned us about. You know, we're going to march around, but when they let the pigeons go, be careful. And I wonder, be careful how it is. You'll find out. But it was nice because we were all dressed as one, and all the other nations were dressed as another. And we'd march out, stand in one place, look up. There was a lot of standing around, waiting for the teams before us and the team afterwards. And it was real great. And we sit there and listen to the tributes and the music. And then they let the pigeons go. And then we understood what to watch out for. Those pigeons dropped and pooped on us.
Well, you talked a little bit about meeting athletes from other countries. Do you remember any specific interactions? Did you make friends with anybody from another country?
I remember the guys that I really approached from different countries. I'd walk to them, and we just couldn't speak. And it wasn't like I have, you know, after you become a celebrity athlete, you meet people and you have interpreters. In those days, there was no one to interpret anything for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember some of the guys from Yugoslavia or whatever different countries, and one big weightlifter, powerlifter. We see each other every day and just smile. All we had was smiling. We'd smile at one another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I can remember, the smiles that we interchanged. We did give smiles, great smiles, like, I see you, good to see you today, hope you're doing okay. We said it all in smiles.
That's wonderful. So who is your biggest competition in terms of competition from another country in boxing? Who were you looking out for?
Well, in boxing, the great country then were the two superpowers. That would be the United States and Russia itself.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was careful and mindful that you may have to meet the Russians, and they would be the ones that you could get beat up by. So we were careful of that, and generally we'd meet the United States. So somehow we'd meet Russia at the end of the tournament. And that's what happened with me especially.
Mm-hmm. And how did that go? Like, what were those interactions like with the Soviet athletes?
Well, once again, all the athletes are friendly. There was no mistreating or meanness one to another. We, I guess, see one another in the Olympic Village and just as happy and smile and see one another. Like I said, we all had these great smiles, but we understood where the competition was going to come from. There was never any animosity or anything at all,
mm-hmm.
Just friendliness. I had a total of four boxing matches, and my last one would be my opponent from Russia.
And can you tell me more about that?
Well, My opponent from Russia had won, of course, all of his fights, and this would be my last fight, and I think it was my fourth fight, and he probably had the same thing, but the luxury for me that the Russian opponent had already beaten the Mexico representative. So when I got into the ring, they were automatically pulling for me.
Oh, that must have been nice.
So everyone was cheering and cheering for me. That was really good, just because he had defeated their representative.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like a hometown atmosphere there.
Yeah.
But getting into the ring, like I said, I'd already surprised myself. I wanted to make the Olympics, and I wanted to win every boxing match. I didn't want to get beat up or anything, but I had no idea that I would become an Olympic gold medalist, none whatsoever. So getting into the ring that day, it had already qualified me, and at the final match, even if I just got in the ring, I'd automatically be a silver medalist. And I remember telling my mom, well, even if I don't win, I'll have a silver medal. My mom never said much, but hurry home and eat. And so getting in the ring, and I used my jab just like I was told over and over. He would continuously follow me, and I would throw shots, and he'd come and follow me. I wasn't the most experienced boxer, but I could really hit hard. I was a hard hitter, what they call a puncher. And he just ran into a lot of shots of mine. And I remember that altitude. Not like New Mexico. This was really something. Your chest start burning, your throat is dry, and you feel like you may want to faint if the fight goes another moment, if you have to throw another. This was the second round of my throwing a lot of shots and jumping away from the Russian shot punches. Wow. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And just as when I didn't have any more, the referee stepped in, pull us apart, and declared that I was the winner of that boxing match. I was then the Olympic heavyweight champion of the world.
And how did it feel? What were you thinking and feeling?
This one, to win that boxing match, was probably the most thrilling thing that had ever happened to me in my life, because I'd never had a dream to come true. Years beforehand, I went to Job Corps, especially because I was a high school dropout. They promised, Lyndon Johnson promised war on poverty, and I qualified for the Job Corps program to get a second chance at education and get a vocational training. And so when I went away, I just thought I was going to go back to Houston and earn $1,000 and live happily ever after. I had no idea that dreams happen for people. So in that boxing match was stopped, I went into almost shock. I said, this can't be happening. I'm winning the thing. And I remember watching over and over the story of Jim Thorpe, who was an Olympic gold medalist and Native American.
Mm-hmm.
That story over and over, I used to watch it. And there I am being given the Olympic wreath afterwards, and that medal put around my neck, it was unbelievable. Even some days now, when I rethink it, I'm in shock.
Mm-hmm.
But it's equally as thrilling, just a memory. I had nothing like that ever happened to me, nothing.
It's very thrilling. So one famous picture from that match is afterwards when you were waving a small American flag. Can you tell us about that and how that came about?
Oh, and I said earlier about meeting fellow Olympians from all over the world. No one spoke the same language, but I'd meet people who looked just like me. And so that was kind of confusing because I didn't know. I thought everyone, especially looked like me, spoke English. And so I'm going into the ring. You have your robe, your trunks, everything, and your shirt. Everything is representing your country. But then there was talked about over 500 million people watching that boxing match. I said, they are going to think that I'm from somewhere else. They're going to look at me and say, where is he from? So I had the small American flag for good luck in my trunks. Some lucky beads and everything I'd gotten from Sergeant Rogers. And we said if I win a boxing match, I said I got to make certain I tell them where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
I got to show everybody where I'm from. Just hoping that I'd win the boxing match. But can you believe the fight is over? They got ready to give me my robe. I reached into the pocket, got the flag. I said, generally, we bow to each corner anyway, just to show that how humble you are to win the judge's decision. And I bowed as I normally would, but at this time I held the flag as I bowed, showing it off. I said, now they know where I'm from. Now they know where I'm from. And people start cheering so much, I actually waved the flag. Just a little flag, my souvenir, to make certain everyone knew where I was from. Not a protest, nor anti-protest, not about a boycott. It was just a thrilling moment from the Olympic Village to let them know, he's really from America. Oh!
That's a great story. I hadn't heard that version of it yet.
Well, but that's the truth. And there was nothing else. A lot of people, afterwards I heard that it was in the newspapers across the country and what it meant and how it felt to a lot of people. But it wasn't protest or anything. It was just a happy teenager wanting everyone to know where I was from.
Yeah. Well, George, do you remember that the 68 Games were the first Olympic Games, the summer games at least, where they implemented standardized testing, drug testing? Do you remember anything about that, and did you have to have a drug test?
No, I don't remember any kind of drug test at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in those times they were testing some of the events that had a history, like wrestling and weightlifting and stuff, of people using steroids and all of those things,
mm-hmm.
and different hormones with some of the women teams. But there wasn't too much suspicion in boxing at that time.
Yeah. Well, do you remember any female Olympians? So some of the women Olympians, and do you remember meeting any while you were there, and what did you think about that?
Yeah, it's strange because there was a runner on the Olympic team. Her name was Iris Davis. She was a track star. I think she had come in representing Tennessee State, and I don't want to misquote it and be wrong, but anyway, she was a nice-looking lady, and I used to go in the evening time and walk around with she and some of the other boxing members and chat. I think I had a crush on her. And I had no idea how she was doing in the track. No idea, but Wyoming Tyrus, I think.
Tyrus, yeah.
Yeah, Tyrus, yeah. And Willie, can't think of Willie's last name now. There are a few that we see daily, and we'd wave and say hello to them. But we didn't have a lot of conversation with them, and I just watched the other swimmers. Of course, there was one girl who was on the diving team who was really friendly with me, and I used to see her daily because she complained also about her backs. I didn't know that diving could hurt, you know, you could hurt your back and get a sore back and things of that nature. And you see them on the track field, but not too much mingling. No one really had that much time.
Uh-huh.
And if you didn't have time to see the events of other athletes, I didn't, because we were all in preparation of our own events.
Right. That's too bad.
Yeah, I missed that because everyone saw us on television, but we couldn't see. We didn't even get much television on the events in the village.
Right. Well, did you witness Tommy Smith and John Carlos's protest on the medal stand?
We only saw it part on the television.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was not at the field, but I remember one afternoon there was a media by, I don't know how many of them, like soldiers, they were following and asking questions of John Carlos. And he was walking, he was angry, and he turned around and tell them something, he walked around, and I felt real bad. because at that point we knew they had dismissed him. He had to leave the Olympic Village. And I remember watching him. I'd see him out on the field and doing his warm-ups on the track. He was always a happy-go-lucky guy, but this day he had this mean look on his face and hurt. No one wanted to be dismissed. Even if you lost, you didn't want to be kicked out of the Olympic Village. I mean, this is all we lived for. I remember feeling so sorry for him. I had a feeling of, it was almost like grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it on his face as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
But that's what I saw with my own eyes. I didn't see it on television. Of course, there was a lot of reports leaving the Olympic Village about us in the Olympic Village. But this is one of those things I saw, an athlete looking at another athlete. And I'd known hurt. And I saw that in his face.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you remember any specific memories of hearing about record-setting events while you were there?
Oh, yes. And that's when I told you I'd heard about the Olympics, and you get a lot of, you're pushed into athletes. Young people are pushed into being athletes, and people believe in you, and we do it because people believe in us. Going to the Olympics, winning the gold medal and all that, that didn't mean a whole lot because you don't know anything about it. But one morning, I went to eat one morning, well, it was a brunch late, and there was Bob Beamon. Beamon? Yeah. Bob Beamon.
Yes.
And he was eating his lunch, getting his tray, and he had this beautiful thing around his neck. And everyone was admiring it. It was the first Olympic gold medal the team had won. He had evidently long jumped and broke the record, world record he had broken. And it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. An Olympic gold medal. That's when I said, I sure wish I had one of those. It was so beautiful. I'd never, you heard about, we've won a lot of medals, Olympic medals and AAU medals and Golden Glove medals. We won those things, but this thing was like something out of a treasury from the middle of the earth or from the deep from out of the earth. It was a shine to it, but not too shiny, but it was like nothing I had ever seen in my life, that Olympic medal. And I looked and looked. Everyone would just look and pile around him, but we didn't dare ask to touch. And
so,
that was when I said, I sure would like one of those. Other than that, I had no idea. I just thought it was going to be another, among other trophies we'd won, but not like that.
Yeah.
That was the first one we'd seen. The whole team
marveled
at this.
So did
No, not only the whole team, the whole village. I mean, everyone in that room. Because we all ate together in a national restaurant.
So did you wear your medal after you won it? Did you wear it around the village?
Yeah, but after I saw that one with him, once you won the gold medal, I wore that thing everywhere. I never did take it off.
So is there anything else that stands out in your mind about the time that you spent there? Any other memorable or interesting events or experiences before the closing ceremony?
Yeah, but I had such great days because there would be reporters coming in from places. I wasn't accustomed to that kind of attention at all, but reporters would travel in from all over the country, and for some reason they would seek me out to do interviews. And I didn't understand why. This time I didn't understand celebrity at all. And daily, one would want to meet me, sit at the restaurant. One would come out to the, we're going to sit by the field and talk. That was an amazing thing to let celebrity come alive because here was a boy who would barely knew how to fly on an airplane, sit in the airplane seat, buckle up the seatbelt. There was being interviewed daily and asked for autographs. It blew me away. It recreated me. That's what it did.
I'm sure. Quite a recreation and and yeah. an amazing experience. So what do you remember about the closing ceremony?
I didn't attend the closing ceremony at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gotten the Olympic Village, and then it was about, from one moment, remember this, no one really, I picked up the small American flag and waved that flag. And after the match, I was whisked. This time we could leave the Olympic Village with friends, and a friend of mine's Colonel Barney Ofield, who worked for Lytton Industries, who was the sponsor of the Job Corps Center where I got my training, and I had a job with them by then. They took me to the hotel, bought me dinner, and let me go into a hotel room to call all my friends and families. And I was then what you call someone that the media wanted to talk to. Everywhere I went, I didn't have time for anything else but to go pack my clothes and leave early the next 2 days.
Mm.
I didn't. The closing ceremony happened pretty much right after my boxing match.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you do right after the games? It sounds like you returned home, and what did
you do? Yeah, right after the Olympic Games, I had my job, and I was representing San Francisco Golden Gloves, but they asked me where would I like to go. I said I'd like to go home to my family, and I went to Houston, Texas.
And what was your homecoming like?
So my brother picked me up at the airport, and when they picked me up, my family had a little sign on his car. It said, George Foreman, Olympic champion. Welcome home, George Foreman. They drove me from the airport home and tooting the horn and blowing it down the street. Now, some people would look out the window, but it was a little happy for the family. I remember going to my mom's little humble house. She had some food fixed for me, and we hugged and told old stories. My dad come over, and it was really a wonderful feeling.
Mm-hmm. Does sound.
I left there, their little boy came back there, celebrity boy.
Yeah.
They treated me so nice. They already treated me nice anyway, but this time they were so proud.
Oh, I'm sure.
My family was so proud.
Oh. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about amateurism and the difference between, you know, what amateurism was like in 68 and amateur boxing in 68 versus amateurism now and what the differences are, you think?
Yeah, I was thoroughly an amateur, and all of us, I remember Harlem Mobley. Remember, you'd have to check the history on those names that I mispronounced.
Okay.
Mobley, Harlem Mobley from D.C. He was a mini flyweight. And I experienced being on a team with guys who had families. They had sacrificed to get to the Olympics, and they all had families, children. They didn't have jobs, and so they really suffered. And I remember them, some of the guys who had troubles of this sort, asking the manager of the Olympic team, how can they get a few dollars to send home? And they said, I'd heard them say, we have an emergency fund that we may be able to help you, but we can only give you a little. And I can't remember the amount. It was so minute. I heard about it. And they said, we can get to see your family to help them. And this guy was like, man, I need help. These desperate people, I need help. And they were crying out. I was just a teenager, so I wasn't in that shape. And there were some people who would pass around shoes, different teams would say, well, if you guys want a pair of boxing shoes, Adidas would want you to try these with rubber. I enjoyed them because the other shoes were slippery anyway. No one ever gave us anything. It was a total sacrifice. I left my job. No one paid me while I was away. I was just hoping I had my job when I came back.
Mm-hmm.
And today I see where people are giving appearance fees. I'm happy for them because they will never have the horror stories like Harlem Mobley or some of the other teammates I had who didn't have anything. and didn't even look, even after you win an Olympic gold medal, didn't look forward to anything. I won an Olympic gold medal, just went back to my job in Pleasant, California, and they took me back.
Mm-hmm.
So to see guys who are able to go to the Olympics and then get some appearances fees or some assistance is a miracle, and a wonderful miracle.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make them physically any better, though.
Right.
No one is any better than what we were then. It's just that there's somewhat easement in what you're doing. I mean, you benefit as much as the athletes can benefit as much as the people who work for the Olympics.
Right. Well, what one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful, somebody who was hoping to make it into the Olympics for boxing or for some other sport? What advice would you give them?
Well, I always tell there's something about, and I'm a preacher and I do this by profession. I mean, that's my profession now for the last, 35 years. Anyway, I was preaching last Sunday and I told them that because I learned as an athlete, the easiest thing in the world is to quit. And it's, you can do it so easily, but it's the most hard thing to ever live down. You quit today, and it haunts you for the rest of your life. And I tell them the hardest thing is to do to keep getting up, keep trying. It's very hard, but you have nothing but pleasant memories for the rest of your life for doing as much.
It's good advice. So, George, what do you think is the legacy of the 1968 Olympic team, and what was the legacy of those games on your life?
Oh, boy. It made for me a chance to see their dreams come true. And I think the 1968 Olympics were going to always be remembered because it was the advent of, what is the big word for media? Media? Gigantic media. Isn't that another word?
Broadcasting?
Yeah, for media. I mean, this was like mass media.
Mass media, yes.
Yeah. Happened 1 second, and it's, for the next second, it's in your home. And the Olympics were the first one to really take advantage of that. And it'll always be remembered as that. And it could have been the Olympics that could have derail all other Olympics, because when the two guys did the demonstration with the gloves,
mm-hmm.
that hit the whole world. Everyone saw it. It wasn't like you got to see it in delayed playback or something like that. I mean, it was like instant AP, UPS, and television, media. And the whole world saw that two people can show displeasure, and it led to 1972 when they killed all those athletes in the Olympic Village in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
If the other had never happened, no one would have ever thought that the Olympics could have been a place to venture frustration and all of that. And I'm not happy about that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I could have spoken to John Carlos and Tommy Smith when they were young, I would have told them, let's keep this clean. Let's not do this, because if the world will see that anyone can just get this much attention, they're going to come back to our village and do it again, worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. So the Olympics will be remembered in 68 as the Olympics that almost destroyed all the Olympics.
I see. Well, George, can you talk a little bit about some of the biggest highlights in your career in your boxing career after the Olympic Games, and a little bit about your book, your autobiography?
Yeah, and after the Olympics, of course, I never intended to be a professional boxer, but everyone was so proud of me with that gold medal. And Then they started asking, when are you going to be a pro? When are you going to be heavyweight champ of the world? I didn't know all, nor did I think about all those things. I was trying to get myself in college because the people in the Job Corps, they wanted me to further be a teacher and everything. They were helping me and help me get into college and all those things. But I guess it was a political year, 68, where they were going to change presidents, and there was some uncertainty in the atmosphere. So I just turned professional, and I won quick about 30-some-odd boxing matches, became heavyweight champ of the world. So not only did boxing bring me a little fame, I had a little money. And, of course, being heavyweight champ of the world, you really get this feeling of superiority, winning boxing matches, and you're on television all the time. Not only all your dreams coming true, you're making dreams happen then. My family was well off for a change. And so I wrote about all of those happenings and that by George, the autobiography of George Foreman, mm-hmm. to tell people about how one can begin humble in the United States and the sky's the limit mm-hmm. if you're willing to work. I got a lot of things from a lot of people, but I had to really train and work out physically myself. I punished myself, but there were a lot of great things happening to me. Mm-hmm. And it went on, as a matter of fact, brought me to the doorstep of God Almighty, where I had an experience after the boxing match that really made a preacher out of me.
And what was
That's what I do now.
Mm-hmm. And what was that experience?
Well, then I went back to the dressing room in 77 after my comeback fight with Jimmy Young, and I had a vision. I was dead and alive in a split second. Now, at that time, I didn't believe in religion. I just believed in all those dreams that was coming true. I'd lost the title, was on my way to get it back again. And as I fought to save my life, I couldn't fight anymore. I was dead, and I was in this dark place like a dump yard of every sad thought I'd ever had in my life. And I looked around and saw everything I'd worked for all those years crumble like ashes behind me. And I got mad, anger, because there I was dead and there was no more. I couldn't be helped, like someone drop you in the sea and there's no way of coming out of there. And I said, I don't care if this is death, I still believe there's a God. When I said that, it was a gigantic hand reached into nothingness and pulled me out of hopelessness. And I was alive in the dressing room with blood and flowing through my body. They picked me off the floor. And I laid there, my doctor behind me holding my head. I told him, Dr. West, move your hands. The thorns on his head are making him bleed. He looked at me strange, but I saw blood coming down my forehead. And my masseur, Mr. Fuller, was holding my hand. I said, Mr. Fuller, you move your hand. He's bleeding where they crucified him. Everybody looked at me, but I saw it. And I jumped off the table, ran into the shower, and started screaming, I'm born again. Hallelujah, I'm clean. Hallelujah, I'm born again. And I tried to go out, and they said, nope, you got to put on some clothes first. But they tied me, pulled me down, and put me on the dressing room table, and I started screaming, Jesus Christ was coming alive in me. And they held me down pretty good. And finally, I heard a voice that I come to my friends, and they don't believe me. And I come to my brothers, they don't understand me. And it could have been vice versa, one way, the other way. Then I heard the voice, and now I go to my father, and I start screaming, don't let Jesus go. And next thing you know, it was over. And he had gone. And I said, you witness a miracle, and you're not going to believe it. This was in 1977. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. I'd seen death. I was alive, and I knew that there had really been a living God, and all of these things I'd heard about were really true stories. And for 10 years, I didn't box,
Mm-hmm.
I stopped. I didn't even make a fist from 77 to 87.
Yeah.
Just devastated, just torn apart by this happening in my life.
That's quite an experience.
Yep, I don't want to have another of those.
Well, before we close the interview, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about?
No, other than that, I lived a good life. I found out I waved a small American flag because, and people start they jumped on my back about it. How could you do that? The other brothers were doing this. Why did you do this? And as the years would grow, I told them, because I believe in America. I truly love this country. And they knocked me. And then at 45, well, I really was broke. And about 37 years old, I had to come back to boxing. I was given a second chance to box, get a boxer's license, and able to start from the bottom and work my way all the way up again to be champion of the world. And when I did it, I remember telling my kids, see, I told them as a teenager, I told you this was the home of a second and a third chance. I was given a second chance, you know. Not given anything, but just a chance.
Yeah.
So they asked me when they were giving me my license hearings in California, they didn't want me to come back into boxing because of my age. And the state attorney had a representative there and asked me, why would you want to come back to boxing, George? And I said, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's a great answer.
That's the answer to my life.
Sounds good. Well, George, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your memories. I'm going to shut off the recorder now.
Okay.